Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. On today's show, we're sharing stories of Appalachian survival and hope for people who are facing some tough realities. We'll hear what happened to high school student Lillian Still Thomas when she tried to tell her teachers about what she was dealing with at home.
I was telling them I was having a horrible time, told them all kinds of personal things, and they pretty much told me to my face I was lying.
We'll talk with people who are helping young children who've experienced trauma find hope.
Life does happen, and it's teaching them how to handle things when life happens.
And we'll hear an audio diary of a boy whose father was hiding from the FBI for 15 years. Until one day, the past caught up with him.
And about 10 minutes after I got off the bus, all these cops pulled in our yard, and my dad looked out the window, and he looked at our family in the kitchen and just said, he loves us, and he'll never forget us.
Today on Inside Appalachia, in the face of tough realities, stories of Appalachian victories. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today's show is dedicated to the Appalachian survivors who have lived to tell their stories of overcoming some challenging realities. West Virginia has the third highest percentage of people diagnosed with a mental illness in America, and the second highest percentage of people who have contemplated suicide, according to Mental Health America, a national nonprofit organization that promotes mental health. People who work in the mental health field say there's often a stigma about mental illness. Some people associate mental illness with weakness and often don't hold mental health as much of a priority as our physical health. We're talking about why mental health is important, especially when overcoming trauma. I was watching a TED Talk a while back, and what I heard has stuck with me. The speaker pointed out that if we have a broken arm, we go to the doctor for treatment. But if we have a mental injury or have friends who are going through a hard time, folks often tell them to shake it off. Can you imagine shaking off a broken arm? I asked Marshall University Associate Professor of Counseling Carol Smith to explain why shaking off a wound to your heart is not easy to do. Smith says things like betrayal of trust or loss of hope can complicate recovery. She's working on several programs meant to help children in West Virginia.
What we're seeing is that if you can intervene in a youngster's life at a young enough age, you can literally change the trajectory of their entire life. So instead of, you know, curving over into the bad side and the badlands in their lives in terms of, and by badlands, I mean things like acting out, truancy, drug use, oppositional defiant disorder, those kinds of things where a child is just marked by anger and acting out, you can actually change the path that they take into a much more positive path so that they foster personal resilience, so that they foster sensitivity to other people, and become people who are capable of living much happier lives and without a lot of collateral damage. Because it costs an awful lot of money to take care of somebody who is angry and lashing out.
Why is that?
Well, because if a family can't manage it, and oftentimes they cannot, then you end up getting the justice system involved, and the justice system gets involved, and that usually involves a lot of salaries. And before long, you end up in adjudicated care, which is also exceptionally expensive. The last resort is to end up in prison, and that's incredibly expensive. That is more expensive than higher education. Frankly, as a professor, I'd much rather see these youngsters in higher ed than in jail.
Mm-hmm. If we think as parents that our kids might be going through something, how do we approach it without over-dramatizing it? Do you have any advice for that?
That's a really, really good question. I teach a crisis intervention class, and if your child is in crisis, the very best thing that you can do is not match the emotional intensity of the child. The child is probably spinning up and is feeling quite elevated in a bad way. But the adult needs to stay in their adult place, and there's a heuristic that I use, low, slow, calm, and strong. Keep your voice low, speak slowly, stay in your calm place, and remain emotionally strong for your child and give your child the structure that the child needs so that the child can get back to emotional equilibrium. And then encourage the child, see, you pulled yourself together. That is excellent. Well done. And that fosters resilience in the child, and the child begins to realize that he or she can pull him or herself together and get back to emotional equilibrium, have that emotional regulation, and press on. And you don't spend a whole lot of time paying attention to it, because that can inadvertently reinforce it. And that's exactly what you're asking. You don't want to do that.
What about the kids who just don't want to talk about it, or they don't seem to act like they want to talk about it? So these services might be offered within the schools, but they just don't seem to be interested in wanting to talk. But we know as adults that they're going through probably something very difficult.
As adults, what we need to do is to what I call plant seeds of availability for a youngster, be that strong person who's in their life, who believes in them, and who is available within limits to listen to them when they're ready to speak. And oftentimes the simple phrase, "when you're ready," will help a youngster know that they can come back when they are indeed ready and talk about it. Maybe they're not ready to talk about it right then, but if they get permission from an adult, "when you're ready," then chances are good they'll come back and they'll have that look on their face and you know they're ready to talk.
West Virginia has some high mental health illness rates.
It is high. Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that is? Any ideas?
Well, I have some ideas. I don't have a research to base any of this on, but I do have some ideas. You look around and we are either frequently listed as either the poorest state or the second poorest state in the nation. And you look around and you can see that. We have one of our major industries, coal, frittering out in front of our very eyes. And it doesn't look like coal is going to come back the way it has come back in the past. That's a very scary prospect for many, many families and many, many counties in West Virginia. So we're seeing a domino effect of things like teachers getting laid off and the secondary businesses getting into financial trouble because the coal mining industry is depressed. This causes an awful lot of anxiety in families. How are we going to make ends meet? How are we going to put food on the table? How are we going to make our payments? Those kinds of things. And that kind of stress can cumulatively lead to mental illness.
And what should they do when they're trying to be strong for their kids and trying to find a way out and they have lost hope? What would you suggest for at least folks in West Virginia?
In a perfect world, there would be a mental health counselor or someone else, a mental health professional, available nearby to help them out, but that doesn't exist in a lot of our counties. So a person should reach out to their circle of social support in whatever form that is, whether it's through their faith base, through their family. And even this may sound silly, but one of the very best things that a person can do for their own mental health is simply to go take a walk. I know that sounds very simplistic, but taking a walk and getting your heart pumping and having some time to think while you're moving can actually do quite a lot to help with one's stress load. And again, to remember to stay in that adult place, particularly with a child who is crying and is upset, to just remember, I am the adult here, and it's okay for me to show my emotions, but not to necessarily to lose control with my child, to give my child a sense of hope, because when my child is okay, then things are better for the family also. Instead of things spiraling out of control, they're sort of building up. Hmm. And there are small incremental steps that a person needs to take. And the biggest thing is simply just to realize, whoa, my stress load is really high here. How can I deal with this high stress load in a way that's positive rather than destructive? That's a lot easier said than done, but just raising that self-awareness and choosing to be positive rather than destructive, that's the key. That's the place, that's the watershed moment.
There is life after trauma. There's lots of negative statistics and hard things to deal with as West Virginians and Appalachians a lot of times. But there is hope after that. And you mentioned it was called post-traumatic growth. Tell us more about that.
Post-traumatic growth refers to the notion that there is indeed what you just said. There's life after trauma. And not only any old life after trauma, but better life. That after a trauma occurs in a person's life, and by trauma I mean things like a sudden job loss or a car accident or a death of a close loved one or an assault of some kind, the things we typically think of very bad things happening to a person, a house fire, those kinds of things. Those are traumatic events. When a traumatic event happens in a person's life, the idea of post-traumatic growth occurs when, in the process of making sense of what happened, the meaning of what happened changes from, instead of it being, oh, there's something wrong with me, no, this bad thing happened, but I've learned I'm stronger than I thought I was, and I can rally my resources, and together we can become stronger than we were before the trauma happened. More thankful, more personally resilient, more able to press forward in the face of frustration, more able to be persistent, more able to have hope and hang on to a sense of hope, even when things are not looking, you know, sunny and shiny right in the moment.
Smith specializes in trauma therapy and heads up the graduate counseling program at Marshall. Smith is also helping to launch a new certificate program for graduates to specialize in violence, loss, and trauma, an area of study that could have a great impact on the region.
I think the more that we understand about traumatic stress and understand what to do about it in the face of it, I think the stronger and more resilient we become as a state. And when we can foster that kind of hope and that kind of resilience, then we change the future of our state.
Very well said. I think that's all that I have. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was Associate Professor of Counseling Carol Smith telling us that there is post-traumatic growth or life after these crappy things that happen to us that make us sad or even doubt our abilities. In other words,
if you're going through hell, keep on going, don't slow down. If you're scared, don't show it, you might get out, or the devil even knows you're there.
Go ahead, roll your eyes if you want, but somebody is dancing right now, ready to face another day because of that message in that song. We also found information about a crisis text line. The idea is to reach young people because, well, that's how most of young people communicate these days, right? The site says you can text anything at any time. Just text GO to 741-741. You can also find more information and more hotlines by going to our website at wvpublic.org. Professor Carol Smith is also a member of the American Counseling Association and helped develop a program meant to help children who've experienced abuse, neglect, or other types of trauma succeed in school. The program was launched by the West Virginia Center for Children's Justice. It's called Handle with Care. It started on the west side of Charleston, West Virginia in 2013, and it's now expanding to Kentucky and in other states across the nation. Roxy Todd spent a day recently at the Mary C. Elementary School, the place where it all began.
Mary C. Snow Elementary School is located in a neighborhood where it can be stressful to be a child. The west side of Charleston has gained a bad reputation for drug crimes and violence, and in 2014, the city of Charleston as a whole saw an increase in both criminal activity and violent crimes. While these crimes are usually committed by adults, that doesn't mean children aren't affected by them. And that's where the Handle with Care program comes into play. If a child is exposed to crime, violence, or abuse, police notify the principal and school counselor by the start of the next school day.
When I first heard about the Handle with Care program, I thought, that's the program for us.
Janet Alio is the school nurse at Mary C. Snow.
Probably 75% of our children are in some form of traumatized living environment from a day-to-day situation. Sometimes it's repeated belly aches or repeated headaches. We just had a situation recently where a child who normally doesn't come to the clinic started coming in every morning with a headache, with a headache, with a headache. And so if I see that it becomes a pattern, or if they look like they may be in distress when they come in, then, you know, I will go ahead and talk to them, say, you know, well, how was your night? What was, you know, did anything happen over the weekend?
But it's not always clear when something traumatic has occurred in a student's life. The first step in the Handle with Care program is when police officers send schools a form after they respond to traumatic events with children present.
And this form just merely says the child's name, the date and time of the incident, and that's it.
When I start to see the emotion coming, I call it to attention and we talk about it.
Ms. Helm teaches special ed at Mary C. Snow Elementary. She says Handle with Care helps teachers modify the way they interact with children who need special attention.
Because when you have a kid that's not typically acting out, then all of a sudden the child's acting out. For a teacher, that can be frustrating. But if you know, okay, there's something going on with that child, then as a teacher, you know, okay, let me look at things differently. Let me try to accommodate the child in a way that would help the child. Or let me see if, okay, I can get the counselor to talk with the child at that time. But I think more so when we know that there's something, then we know how to handle it in a different fashion.
The second step is where the school staff figure out what resources a child might need if they've experienced a traumatic event. Sometimes it's talking with a school counselor, or going to the health center for some extra sleep, or spending time in the library with the school's therapy dog, Paka.
What kind of dog is Paka? Trained dog.
Or, if the parent gives permission, the child might also be matched up with a counselor who travels to the school.
Play is a child's work, and that's how they work through things, and that's how they learn, and that's how they make sense of their world.
Colleen Moran is one of the therapists with Harmony Health Services, and she comes to the school to help children cope with stress and traumatic situations.
Some of the types of things that we do are teaching relaxation. With children, a lot of times you'll use play activities to do that, such as blowing bubbles for breathing exercises, or teaching them to tense and release their muscles to get rid of muscle tension. If you do it in a way that's a game, they're much more likely to do it, and they don't realize that they're working and that they're making therapeutic progress.
Today, Colleen Moran is talking with 5-year-old Ethan Napier. They're blowing bubbles and working with the toys inside the therapy room, where a scene from a forest has been painted over the colorful, bright blue walls.
My name is Ethan.
And what grade are you in?
Kindergarten.
In 2012, Ethan's brother, Jalil Clements, was killed when he was hit by a car on the interstate. Jalil was trying to wave down for help because his mother was being beaten inside the car by her boyfriend. The mental health center here was named in Jalil's memory. Here's Ethan talking with his mom, Lenitra Woodson, about his big brother.
Every night we say our prayers and we say what? We pray for
Jaja.
Jaja, your big
brother.
Every Christmas, his mom gives him some of Jalil's left behind toys as a present from his older brother. So just after Christmas, I visit Ethan's home.
Oh, what is this?
A plane?
And he shows me his new toys from Jalil and his other new toys from Santa, like this one. It's a giant Batman fortress with a dinosaur hidden inside to guard against bad guys.
Like when somebody's out here and Batman could come down here and ran back up and he opened the doors and they could see and the bad guys could run away from his house.
Fighting off bad guys is pretty important to Ethan. So is taking care of his mom. Next, Ethan shows me a photograph of his older brother, Jalil, who he calls Jaja.
Who is this?
Jaja, that's me.
In the photograph, Jalil is holding his baby brother, Ethan. Ethan doesn't remember the accident, his mother says. When she talks about Jalil, Ethan turns away to play another game, and he wipes one tear away from his face.
We go up to the graveyard and put a tree up there, so it's like we have a double Christmas, is what Ethan calls it.
For children who are left to deal with trauma all on their own, there can be fatal consequences. A report called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study found that children who experienced trauma early in life were more likely to abuse substances, smoke, and overeat. Children who experience abusive and stressful situations could lose as much as 20 years off their life, compared with children who grow up in stable, loving families. But teachers and other adults in a child's life can help if they know what to look out for.
Life does happen, and it's teaching them how to handle things when life happens. You know, we can get the love, we can get the support, the nurture that we need. And basically when they come here and we get that handle with care, basically we look at what do they need and how can we help them, and then we fill in from there.
Ms. Helm recently visited a meeting with teachers from across West Virginia.
A teacher brought this up, that there's so much trauma going on in their schools and they don't know how to handle it because they don't have the handle with care. And they don't know how, what resources do we tap into. This is an ongoing problem. It's a growing problem. And one thing they was emphasizing there is that they're seeing it more and more in their younger kids. And that's what basically we have here. We're seeing it in our younger kids.
Thus far, the Handle with Care program has been supported without any extra funding, except for the resources already available to schools and children who need mental care. The program is part of a collaboration between the Department of Justice and their Defending Childhood Initiative, the State Department of Health and Human Resources, and the West Virginia State Police. These groups are now working to help bring Handle with Care to communities throughout West Virginia. There are also similar programs that have sprouted in other states. When President Obama visited West Virginia last year to talk about drug abuse across the nation, he took note of the Handle with Care program.
And I'd really like to see us advertise this more across the country and adopt this as a best practice.
With drug overdose rates in West Virginia the highest in the country, Ms. Helm says more and more teachers are noticing children who are dealing with abuse and neglect.
So it's definitely more prominent now than before. I think before we always thought it was just isolated to Westside Elementary, but now realizing, no, it's going on everywhere. And people are needing answers. They're needing support. They're needing to understand what is handled with care, because that question was asked there. And what do you do, you know, with how does that program work? And so definitely it's much needed in other places.
But as drug abuse and domestic violence continue to barrage families across West Virginia, there simply aren't enough resources to help children deal with trauma. Harmony Health Services, which provides mental health services to the students at Mary C. Snow Elementary, is working to get a mobile mental health care facility for some of the remote areas of West Virginia. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Charleston, West Virginia.
Since the program at Mary C. Snow Elementary is only a few years old, there hasn't been a study about how much the Handle with Care program is affecting children later in life, so we'll have to wait and see what happens when they grow up. When we come back, we'll hear from people at another school in West Virginia who are finding hope with a little help from yet another service in schools. This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Inside Appalachia is available on iTunes, Downcast, Stitcher, and other places. You can also subscribe and catch up on all of our episodes on our website at wvpublic.org. And while you're there, you can also check out our station's other podcasts like The Front Porch, The Poetry Corner, Us and Them, and Mountain Stage. Thanks for listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we're hearing stories about people who have had to learn how to deal with trauma. Sometimes young people who've gone through trauma have a tough time succeeding in school. Just witnessing tragedies can cause kids to have difficulty focusing on their schoolwork later. Some advocates for children are hoping that providing mental health services in schools may also help kids do better academically. And that could help bring up the state's educational rankings. While every school in West Virginia has guidance counselors, a new initiative gives students access to mental health therapists, a place to talk about their challenges with experts. Appalachian Health reporter Kara Lofton visited one of the schools to meet up with some of the students.
Students, time to be an end-of-the-day announcement. Seniors, make sure you log on the press.
There are 719 public schools in West Virginia. 129 have school-based health centers, although note that some elementary middle or middle high schools share a center. Just over 30% of those, including Riverside High School and Bell, have mental health services.
I think it's a good thing because a lot of teenagers struggle with it. Like, everybody has a depression or something wrong with them. Like, they think that And especially in adolescence, the way the brain develops and all that stuff.
That's Lillian Steele Thomas, a senior at Riverside. She has had, as she calls it, a tough life. Over the past 18 years, Lillian has lived with every relative who would take her in. She has also attended 6 or 7 different schools. She is currently living with her boyfriend's parents, the most stable situation, she said, she has had in a while.
Most of the problems, they end up going away after you get older, but some of them, they don't. And getting help young helps you not to have all kinds of horrible issues when you grow up.
Lillian has been diagnosed with depression and anxiety. She is one of 7 students I talked to from 3 schools who have had similar challenges. Most said having a therapist available at school is invaluable. 2 young women from Greenbrier East High School said they wish they had access to one, which they actually do, they just didn't know about it.
For many, many years, there was such a huge focus on academics with No Child Left Behind, so it was all about the test scores. And for many school leaders, they did not see the relationship between mental health and academics. But there are many, many research studies that shows that academics impact mental health and mental health impact academics.
That's Barbara Brady, school counseling coordinator with the West Virginia Department of Education. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 1 in 5 children ages 13 to 18 have or will have a serious mental health condition. West Virginia currently has very little data about the state's childhood mental health, and none that was publicly available. Riverside is Lillian's 2nd high school. The first did not have mental health services. I asked her if having mental health services available at school made any difference to her grades. The short answer, absolutely.
I have good grades now because I can study, but before I couldn't because it wasn't that great. Where I had bad grades, they believed that I wasn't a good student or a good person, but I was telling them I was having a horrible time, told them all kinds of personal things, and they pretty much told me to my face I was lying.
Lillian failed all her classes that first year of high school, except for the 2 that were graded based on participation. She said she thinks she was truant about half the time.
I just didn't feel like going to school anymore. What's the point if nobody cares? And my grades are bad anyway, and it sucks being home, but at least I can, like, go jogging or something, and I can't be in the house.
Being at Riverside, she said, is a world of difference. She feels more supported by both teachers and administrators, who in turn, she said, seem to feel more supported by having referral services available on site. The on-site services also mean she doesn't have to leave school for appointments or make up hours of work. She just shows a teacher her appointment card, then heads down the hall to the clinic waiting room. It's an envelope of support that for most of her life she hasn't gotten from home. Cases like Lillian seem like a success, but administrators like Brady are quick to point out that if schools are not creating an overall better environment for students, placing therapists in schools will not be enough.
It's critical to have those universal preventions, universal support, teaching all students the skills they need to succeed, teaching all students anger management skills, teaching all students conflict resolution skills, social skills, so on and so forth.
The idea is to slowly change the way schools think about mental health and behavioral support. It's not a one-size-fits-all prescription. Schools in Cabell County have very different challenges than schools in McDowell. These schools need to have programs available that they can pick and choose from that work for their school at this time. For Inside Appalachia and Appalachia Health News, I'm Kara Lofton.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from the Benedum Foundation. That's the music for What's in a Name. And since today on our show, we're hearing from people who have fought some tough battles, this next story is also about survival. So for What's in a Name this week, we're visiting a state park that supposedly got its name from a mother and a daughter who got lost in the woods and had no food to eat. It's quite a story. Do you know it? If you know the name of the state park in Appalachia that was named after a starving mother and her daughter, then send us a tweet during the break at InAppalachia. We'll have the answer in just a minute. And still to come, in the second half of our show, we'll hear a radio diary story by a teenager named Frankie, whose father was taken to prison.
When he first left, that was like him dying. I mean, I was the worst than anybody in our family. I couldn't quit crying. I thought I was going to have a breakdown. I was like, no, that's just... It's after he was gone, me and my mom would get in arguments, and I'd want to run away and leave.
That story and more when we return. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. So how did Hungry Mother State Park get its name? I visited the park a few years ago, and I heard that the park got its name after a mother who went out to the woods to find her children food. While in the hills of Virginia, she fell into a snake pit and was bitten. Despite the venom racing through her veins, she clawed her way back to her children to deliver the food, only to collapse and die shortly after. Our producer, Roxy Todd, visited Hungry Mother State Park, and she went searching for whether there's any truth to this story. At the park's visitor's center, she met Darren Handy, a seasonal park ranger, who said the story goes back to the time during the 1700s.
Of course, all this never was a park then, obviously. A lot of Indians were settled in the area, especially over in the Tazewell area. People came through and was colonizing everything. I believe it was somewhere over in the Tazewell area that a family was over there, and the agreement was that the Indians wouldn't come there, and then of course the white people wouldn't come in the other areas. But some Indians raided the area and killed the husband and took the wife and a little girl and possibly another girl. All this is actually folklore. They don't know for sure if it actually happened or not, but it seems that there's a good chance it was. But Marley was the little girl's name, the infant's name. The rumor has it that they may have traveled all the way into what now would be Maryland somewhere. Molly's mother was there, and some things happened that they were able to escape. And so they escaped, and they, of course, on foot came back this way. And the story has it that they made it to what we now call Molly's Knob over here, which is the higher point in the park. So when they got up there, of course, they were exhausted. They hadn't had much to eat for days on end. They were by themselves. They don't know exactly if the other child was with her when they took them or if there was another child, but supposedly the little child that was named Molly and her mother made it back down to the park area here. The mother was so exhausted, and for some odd reason she was trying to get to the creek over here, but for some reason she got on top of the high knoll over there, which is now Molly's Knob, popular trail here at the park. And when she got up there, she was so exhausted that she either passed out, fainted, or sat down, couldn't go anymore. So the little child kept coming and made it down to what would be the creek that feeds the lake now. And there were some settlers back there working, either logging something. I don't know if they lived there, but anyway, the child heard them, found them near the water, came back to there, and the little child was so small that she couldn't speak full English. I mean, she just hadn't learned to speak yet. So when they got down there, the people were asking her, you know, what's going on? And the only, supposedly, as the story has it, the only thing she could say was "Hungry Mother."
According to this local story, the settlers helped Molly find her way back up the hill to look for her mother. But by the time they got there, Molly's mom had passed away. Today, there's a small plaque at the top of Molly's Knob to mark the spot where Molly's mother is said to have passed away. Do you have another story about Hungry Mother State Park, or maybe you know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it? Send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag What's in a Name, and we might explore it inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today's show is about survivors and the paths to overcome trauma. Next, we'll hear a story of mental and physical survival. When a person who's been abused leaves their abuser, they're 70 times more likely to be killed in the following weeks than if they just stayed with the abuser. It's something that Christy Salters is all too familiar with. You might recognize the name. Christy's a pioneer in women's boxing. She's the 6-time World Boxing Council champion, but she found herself in the fight of her life outside the ring.
When I
Christy Salters was born a coal miner's daughter. She grew up in Itmann, a coal camp town in Wyoming County just outside of Mullins. She went to Concord University while it was still a college. She fought in several amateur boxing matches and went on to win a few professional fights in Tennessee. In 1993, she signed with flashy boxing promoter Don King.
For a female fighter from small town in southern West Virginia to be sitting across the table from King negotiating a contract, it was pretty overwhelming.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome one of the top women's pound-for-pound boxers, known as the coal miner's daughter, introducing Christy Martin.
But through all that success, Christy was hiding the fact that she was a lesbian. She married her manager, Jim Martin, even though she saw him as a friend.
I lived a lie for 20 years. Very much behind closed doors, it was hell. In front of the camera, lots of people thought I had it made. And, you know, like it was heaven on earth for me, which I was fortunate. I had lots of things, but I wasn't happy.
The couple lived in Florida, and although living a lie, Salter says she was honest with Martin. She told him she had relationships with women. Salter says Martin held that over her head and threatened to blackmail her.
And there was never that perfect time to leave, because as my boxing career got bigger, then my stakes were higher. Like, he would say, I'll tell Don King, I'll go to the media. Everybody will know you're a lesbian, and then, people aren't going to like you. They don't like you anyway. And I believed him.
Salter says Martin was controlling and verbally abusive, but she knew that the majority of the domestic violence deaths happen when the victims try to leave. Salters stuck it out until she reached such a low point that she didn't care what happened. She finally left, and on November 23rd, 2010, Martin attacked her.
I had to live through whatever it was he was going to dish out. Either I had to live through it or I was going to die. I mean, it really, truly did not matter to me until about halfway through the attack. And I was like, you know what? I told him, you cannot kill me.
Martin had already stabbed and pistol whipped her, and once again, her fighting spirit was back.
He kept waiting for me to die, and when he saw I wasn't going to die, he shot me. But I just prayed harder, and God answered my prayers, and I heard the water turn on in the shower, and when the shower turned on, I was able to escape the house and flag down a neighbor, actually, and he took me to the emergency room. They had to lifelight me out, and but here I am, hopefully telling my story to help someone else. I mean, God had to let me live for a reason.
Martin shot her with her own pink 9mm. The bullet missed her heart by about 2 inches. Martin was convicted of attempted murder and sentenced to 25 years in prison. Salters is sharing her story to help others in domestic violence situations. After all, if it could happen to a world boxing champion, she says, it could happen to anyone.
Hopefully I'm touching somebody else. And if that's why I had to go through what I did to help save some other people, then that's okay with me. It's okay, because I made it. And so many people don't.
That was Christy Salters Martin, known as the pioneer of female boxing. Christy was recently chosen to be the first female boxer in the Nevada Boxing Hall of Fame. She'll be inducted during a ceremony this summer. Next, we're going to hear about a young man whose life changed when his father was sent to prison. Frankie always thought his family was pretty normal until the day the FBI showed up. His dad had been hiding from the law for 15 years, and Frankie had no idea. Radio Diaries producer Joe Richmond helped Frankie make his own audio diary about his life. Let's listen.
Hi, my name's Frankie, and I'm going to give you a little tour of the outside of my house, which, like, see,
Where I live, you gotta come off the main road about a mile back on a dirt road, and then here's my house right here. This is a pretty old house. It's been here a while. When we first moved here, we had to move out of our other house because of a situation that happened to my father. We had to move here, and we didn't think this house was going to be worth living in because it was so messed up. The walls were all rotted out. The living room had a big hole in the wall, and there was no bathroom. And it took me and my mom about a month to fix it up. But now we're in it, and it looks like a brand new house, and we're glad to be in it. Okay, now I'm going down the stairs. My sisters are back here talking on the phone, so if you hear a little noise, excuse me. And I'm going to show you a little bit on my Cadillac here, okay? That's out here in my front yard right now. My dad, he had it when I was a baby, and he fixed it up and everything. And he kept it for me until I got 16, old enough to drive it. Now it's my car. I'm going to open the door and let you see what I got in here. It's all red inside. The dash is all in pretty red carpet, and the seats are all carpeted and everything. We got a topper on here, a leather topper, and if you put mink oil on it, shines it. So I got me some mink oil, and I shined it up. It looks pretty good. I'm going to get it painted this summer. It's black now. I'm getting it painted metallic purple or candy apple red. You know, I got a big system in my car, and I like hearing bass. When I turn country on, it sounds good, but whenever it seems like whenever I put rap in, people say they can hear me coming down the road. Boom, 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 boom. You know, and I think that's pretty cool. Kind of makes me feel proud and big and bad and macho, kind of like, you know, getting to drive around in a big, long, nice Cadillac. Well, I'll tell you a little bit about my personality and stuff. I wear nice jeans, nice shirts. You know, I wear Levi's. I will not wear anything if they're not Levi's to school. At home, sure, I wear Wranglers and old raggedy old pants, but you know, I just like looking decent for school, and I like combing my hair decent and looking good. I used to be a wimp in school in the 7th and 8th grade. Nobody liked me, and they used to call me, my name's Frank, and they used to call me Francis, a girl's name, because they thought I was a real big wimp. But since I started playing football in the 9th and 10th grade, and all I did was get a haircut, start wearing decent clothes, and play sports. Now I'm a popular person, you know, and I got a good popularity in school, and I want to keep it going that way.
What's up, bro?
Nothing.
I'm jamming, brother.
My dad used to play music, you know, and he still got his original guitar, and every now and then he'll get it out, play him some songs or something. What song you fixing to sing?
About dreaming or something?
Hey, listen to this. Dreaming, I'm always dreaming. Dreaming, love will be mine. Do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da, searching.
Well, my dad, he's one of the guys back from the old days with his beard and holy jeans. He'll wear the same pants and shirt all the time. You know, he'll wash them. He just wears the same clothes. He buys all these junk cars, old antique cars, and drives old cars. Always playing old music. Just acts like it's the old days still.
I keep it right on dreaming. Keep right on dreaming. Dreaming. Dreaming.
Me and my dad, we go to Chattanooga every weekend up there. We get up every Saturday morning around 6 o'clock, get down there around 7. We set up our tables. They call it 23rd Street Flea Market. It's right on the street. I mean, everybody that drives by can see it.
202 runs about 75. Yeah, I can take 50. Okay, well, I'll be here for a little while. Just come back. All right, thanks.
We have cordless telephones, answering machines, batteries, plungers, TV antennas, cassette tape. We have pictures of Jesus clocks, flower clocks, touch lamps. And then we have our 8-inch speakers all here in the back. So we got a lot of different things. Working at the flea market's a good living for us, because if you got the right merchandise at a flea market, you can make good money. And we make enough every weekend to pay our bills, put food on the table.
Baby.
How'd you do that?
He's eating a taco. He's eating a taco there.
Okay, I'm going to tell you a story about my dad now a little bit. Because he wasn't here a while back. My dad, I don't know how to put this to you here. I'm going to come back up the steps and sit down and talk a little bit here. Okay. About 16 years ago, my dad was a professional singer, and after he got done singing one night, and when he was leaving, there was this guy there, and my dad was friendly to everybody, so my dad gave him a ride, and they left and pulled out of the bar going down the street, and that guy was, you know, drunk, and he jumped over in the seat and grabbed my dad, threw him in the floor, and the car went over in the ditch, flipped over, and the guy was on top of my dad, and he was choking the breath out of him. My dad said, last thing he remembers is seeing the street lights down the street getting dimmer and dimmer. And my dad was a hunter, and he always carried a little buck knife with him for hunting, and he started swinging it, you know, to try to get the guy off of him before he lost his life, and he started swinging it, and he cut the guy, and the guy fell out of the car door, and he told the police at the hospital that my dad just jumped him all of a sudden, started cutting him, and they believed that guy over my dad, and they made the sentence, and they found my dad guilty. So he was going to get 10 to 20 years in prison, and my dad came home and told my mom. So they decided to pack their bags and leave, so they headed down south.
I knew I had to go somewhere where I had no relatives, where anybody looked for us. When you were a baby, you were 6 months old, and so I took an old station wagon and a trailer, and we headed south and never looked back.
Me and my mom and dad, we were all on the run, and I didn't have a clue. I didn't know. I just thought we were just traveling, you know.
We stayed at campgrounds and camped, lived in a tent when you were a baby in the middle of the winter.
I mean, when I think back on it now, it seems crazy, but for food, we knew a guy that owned the grocery store, and he would tell us when the meat, you know, that was out of date, into the dumpster. And after hours, I would be sticking with my feet up in the air and my head down in the big dumpster, digging out hamburger meat and pork chops and anything that we could find, take it home and clean it.
My mom and dad was on the run for 15 years, and I didn't know anything about 15 years. See, I really didn't think it was strange because I didn't know nothing about it until one day I was coming home from school. I got off the school bus. My dad and mom were in the kitchen fixing a waffle iron, and about 10 minutes after I got off the bus, all these cops pulled in our yard, and my dad looked out the window. And he looked at our family in the kitchen and just said, he loves us and he'll never forget us.
Hi, Mom, Frankie, Jenny, Johnny, Angel. You know, I'd give everything if I could be with you tonight.
This here's a tape my dad sent from prison. On here it says to Mommy and all my kids, I love you very much. Love, Daddy.
Guess what? I got the guitar and I'm sitting here back over here in my corner. It's kind of quiet except for the wind blowing. Well, this goes out to my little family.
He'd play on his guitar and sing to us. And I listen to those every now and then.
Oh, my love, my darling, I've hungered for your touch.
When he first left, that was like him dying. I mean, I was the worst than anybody in our family. I couldn't quit crying. I thought I was going to have a breakdown. I was, you know, that's just... So after he was gone, me and my mom would get in arguments, and I'd want to run away and leave. When he left, I didn't know how to crank a chainsaw. I didn't know how to use an axe or drive a straight shift truck or run a business. I had to learn how to do that when my dad was gone. Be the man of the house, because I thought I was going to have to be the man of the house for, you know, for years to come.
I love you, everybody.
Everything's okay, though, now. My dad's home to stay. He won the appeal. He came up the driveway honking the horn. Coming up the driveway with our preacher, and we were all out in the yard waiting to see him. It's the first time I'd seen him for 2 years, and it's just never going to be a day I'll never forget.
Good day. Eat them crackers.
When Dad first left, did you think he'd ever come back?
and thank you to be in jail forever.
I always try to think positive all the time. That Daddy would come home, and he did.
I always say, you know, 16 years of our life that we lived in hell, of the worries and the pressures all the time. But that dark cloud was lifted off of us, and it all has turned out for the best.
I'm free again. Don't care who hears me play or sing anymore. I'll just play a little bit of the song that I wrote about the Lincoln, Nebraska State Prison. It goes like this. When man is set free from a prison that's made of coal.
It was our postmaster, I believe, that turned him in. It was our church. My dad hated him for turning him in, but now it's all over. My dad went in, shook his hand, and told him thank you for turning him in, because now my dad's got a driver's license. She got his GED in prison, got a diploma. There it is right there, right here on this door. It just shows him standing there in the hallway holding up his diploma in the prison there. When people take, you know, their families for granted every day, like tonight, that was the first time in a long time we've ate together at the kitchen table, and it made me feel kind of good just to sit there and look over at my dad, seeing him sitting there knowing that he could still be laying in a prison cell right now, me sitting there looking at that empty chair. Every night when he was gone, I'd sit over and look at that empty chair where he'd sit and just think, now that he's there, I can look over there. He'll sit over and he'll smile at me, you know that he's back home.
Frankie's story was produced by Joe Richmond for the Radio Diaries series. This story originally aired on NPR's All Things Considered in 1997. A few years ago, Radio Diaries revisited Frankie to hear how his life has changed since he was a teenager. And things haven't been easy, but he's pushing through. You can listen to what Frankie shared on the follow-up story on Radio Diaries on our website, wvpublic.org. I'm so proud to share these stories of survival and hope with you. I know life can be hard, and here in Appalachia, sometimes the stats are stacked against us, but they don't define us. And if you're a part of them, keep pushing. Just because it's hard doesn't mean it's impossible. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Radio Diaries. Music in today's show was also provided by Rodney Adkins, Andy Agnew Jr., Ben Townsend, Jake Sheps, and our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Catherine Winter. Our audio mixer is Xander Alloy. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.